One of the easiest ways to get yourself in trouble via the excessive self-regard tendency is estimating deadlines. Overconfidence is a major cause of the planning fallacy, which we'll discuss later. When I agreed to write this book, I thought it would take about 6 months. I'd never written a book before, so I really had no idea. Several of my more experienced friends and advisors counseled that it would probably take a year, and I'm very glad I listened. They were right. All of us are prone to overestimating our abilities. Padding your team with yes-men is deadly because people who always agree with you can't help you correct for this tendency. People who always support your decisions won't prevent you from making huge mistakes. Cultivate relationships with people who aren't afraid to tell you when you're making questionable assumptions or going down the wrong path. They're valuable friends indeed. Confirmation bias. Paradoxically, one of the best ways to figure out whether or not you're right is to actively look for information that proves you're wrong. Confirmation bias is the general tendency for people to pay attention to information that supports their conclusions and ignore information that doesn't. No one particularly likes to learn they've made a bad decision, so we tend to filter the information we pay attention to. The more strongly held the opinion or belief, the more we ignore sources of information that challenge that position. That's why you won't find many political conservatives reading politically liberal sources of news, and vice versa. They already know they don't agree, so why bother? Unfortunately, this makes both positions more and more extreme, since neither side seeks information that may challenge their convictions. The best way to counteract confirmation bias is to intentionally seek out sources of information that challenge your current hypothesis or belief. When Kelsey and I adopted a vegan diet for a number of years, it was easy to also adopt the mindset that we were clearly making the optimal choice for our health, for our animal friends, and for the planet. This worldview naturally made it difficult to pay attention to any source of information that argued the contrary. Ultimately, we changed our minds as a result of finding disconfirming evidence. After reading the book The Vegetarian Myth by Lear Keith, we discovered that vegetarianism isn't as healthy or environmentally friendly as we had originally believed. The book Protein Power by Michael R. and Mary Dan Eads taught us more about how our bodies biochemically process the food we eat and how the feedback loops that exist in our metabolism actually function. As a result, we learned that a few persistent health issues we were experiencing were actually a consequence of our diet. Both books provided evidence that contradicted our original position, and they changed our minds. We learned a great deal from the experience, both about diet and about the importance of paying attention to disconfirming evidence. Paying attention to disconfirming evidence is naturally difficult. It means intentionally looking for reasons you might be wrong, and we usually hate to be wrong. Seeking disconfirming evidence will either show you the error of your ways or provide additional evidence for why your position is actually correct, as long as you suspend judgment long enough to learn from the experience. Looking for disconfirming information is uncomfortable, but it's useful, whatever you ultimately decide. Hindsight bias. How do you feel when you realize you've made a mistake? Hindsight bias is the natural tendency to kick yourself for things you should have known. If you lose your job, you should have known it was coming. If the price of a particular stock you own drops 80% overnight, you should have sold it. If you launch a product and no one buys it, you should have known it wouldn't work. Baloney. If you knew then what you know now, you wouldn't have done what you did. Every decision you ever make will be based on incomplete information. We have to use interpretation to fill in the blanks. Since you're not omniscient, you'll always have more information when you evaluate the results of your actions than you had when you actually made the decision. As a result, it's very easy to feel stupid if things don't turn out the way you expected. It's important to realize that these feelings are irrational. Your decisions were based on the best information you had at the time, and there's nothing you can do now to change them. Don't feel bad about things that you should have seen or should have done. Changing the past is outside of your locus of control, so there's no sense in wasting energy on self-doubt, wondering what might have been. Hindsight bias becomes destructive if you negatively judge yourself or others for not knowing the unknowable. As the saying goes, hindsight is 20/20. Reinterpret your past mistakes in a constructive light and focus your energy on what you can do right now to move in a more positive direction. Performance load. Being busy is better than being bored, but it's possible to be too busy for your own good. Performance load is a concept that explains what happens when you have too many things to do. Above a certain point, the more tasks a person has to do, the more their performance on all of those tasks decreases. Imagine juggling bowling pins. If you're skilled, you may be able to juggle 3 or 4 without making a mistake. The more pins that must be juggled at once, the more likely you are to make a mistake and drop them all. If you want to be productive, you must set limits. Juggling hundreds of active tasks across scores of projects is not sustainable. You're risking failure, subpar work, and burnout. Remember Parkinson's Law. If you don't set a limit on your available time, your work will expand to fill it all. If you don't draw the line somewhere, your work will consume all of your energy, and you'll inevitably burn out. Limits always have consequences. If you're not prepared to handle the consequences, it's not really a limit. If you're working for a manager who expects you to work 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, telling them no by setting limits on your working hours may cost you your job. Working that pace is completely unrealistic, but if you're not willing to accept the possibility of losing the job, you haven't really set the limit. In order to handle the unexpected, you must have unscheduled time to respond to new inputs. The default mindset of many modern businesses is that, quote-unquote, downtime is inefficient and wasteful. Workers should be busy all the time. Unfortunately, this philosophy ignores the necessity of handling unexpected events, which always occur. Everyone only has so many hours in a day, and if your agenda is constantly booked solid, it'll always be difficult to keep up with new and unexpected demands on your time and energy. You can't perform at 110% of your capacity at all times. Use the 4 methods of completion to eliminate, defer, or delegate marginally valuable work that contributes to performance load. By keeping some capacity in reserve, you'll be ready to handle the most important tasks immediately. Energy cycles. Here's the problem with time management. Time is not what needs to be managed. No matter what you choose to do, time will pass. The implicit assumption of time management systems is that every hour is fungible, equivalent to any other. Nothing could be further from the truth. All people are created equal, but all hours are most definitely not. Throughout the day, your energy level naturally cycles up and down. Your body has natural rhythms during the day, which I call energy cycles. Most people are familiar with the 24-hour circadian rhythm, which wakes you up in the morning and makes you feel tired at night. Lesser known is the 90-minute ultradian rhythm, which is described in the book The Power of Full Engagement by Jim Lehrer and Tony Schwartz. The ultradian rhythm influences bodily systems, controlling the flow of hormones throughout your body. When your energy is on an upswing, you're capable of focusing deeply and getting a lot accomplished. When it's on a downswing, all your mind and body want to do is rest and recover. There's nothing abnormal about these changes in energy during the day, but we act as though being on a downswing is somehow a problem that needs to be fixed. Nowadays, it's popular to try to hack this cycle to get more done by resting less. Attempting to work 8 to 12 hours without a break is not uncommon in highly competitive workplaces. Most of us try to overclock our brains with large doses of sugar and caffeine. Some people even resort to abusing prescription or illegal drugs to work a little bit longer or faster. Like all biological systems, humans need to rest and recover for peak performance. Taking a break isn't a sign of laziness or weakness. It's a recognition of a fundamental human need. Paying attention to your natural energy cycles will help you consistently perform at your best over long periods of time. Here are 4 simple ways to work with your body instead of against it. Number 1, learn your patterns. Use a notebook or calendar to track how much energy you have during different parts of the day, as well as what you're eating and drinking. Do this for a few days, and you'll notice patterns in how your energy waxes and wanes, allowing you to plan your work accordingly. Number 2, maximize your peak cycles. When you're in an up cycle, you're capable of getting a lot accomplished, so plan your day to take advantage of that energy. If you're doing creative work, carve out a 3 to 4 hour block of time during an upcycle to get it done. If your work consists of attending a lot of meetings, plan the most important meetings during the upcycle. Number 3. Take a break. When you're in a down cycle, it's better to rest than attempt to power through it. Rest and recovery are not optional. If you don't rest now, your body will force you to rest later by either cycling down longer than usual or by getting sick. During a down cycle, go for a walk, meditate, or take a 20-minute nap. Relaxing on the down cycle can restore your energy, allowing you to take full advantage of the next upcycle. And number 4, get enough sleep. Sleep deprivation results in a prolonged down cycle, which gets in the way of getting things done. To ensure you get enough sleep each evening, set a timer to go off an hour before you'd ideally be in bed sleeping. When the timer goes off, turn off the computer or the TV, go through your evening routine, make a cup of non-caffeinated tea, and spend some time with a book you enjoy. When your reading comprehension starts to go down, you'll know it's time for bed. Paying attention to your energy cycles during the day will help you get the most out of the time you have available. Take maximum advantage of your up cycles and rest on the down cycles, and you'll be amazed at what you can accomplish in a day. Stress and recovery. During my last semester of college, around the time I created the personal MBA, I pushed myself to the breaking point. I was taking 22 credit hours of classes across 3 subjects: business information systems, real estate, and philosophy. Every class I took had some kind of capstone project on top of the final exam. 2 of the courses I was taking were at the graduate level, and each required a 20-plus page paper on an extremely complex topic to pass. I had far too much work to do in the time available. By the last 2 weeks of the quarter, I was an absolute wreck, sleep-deprived, exhausted, and stressed beyond belief. Everything got done on time, but the workload took its toll, and it took me a few weeks of doing nothing after graduation to fully recover. Even though it wasn't pleasant, I'm glad I found my breaking point. Here's why. Now I know how much I'm capable of doing and how much is too much. I know more about how my mind and body react to stress, and I'm better able to identify the warning signs of taking on too much before things get out of hand. As a result, I've learned to keep myself running at about 90% of capacity, which is enough to get a lot done without burning out. At any given time, I'm writing, consulting, and working on a few interesting side projects. Paying attention to stress and recovery ensures that I don't take on too much to handle. Learning my breaking point has made it much easier to know when to push and when to slow down. It's impossible to know how much you're capable of until you decide to push your limits. As long as you stay safe by limiting your experimentation to things that won't kill you or do permanent damage, you can learn a ton about how you work by stretching yourself to the limit. The knowledge you gain will help you make better choices in the future about which projects to take on and how much is too much. That said, our bodies are not machines that are designed to operate at maximum capacity at all times. It's remarkably easy to fall into the trap of comparing your output to an idealized version of yourself who can build Rome in a day, then build the Great Wall of China as a fun side project. If that's your vision of personal effectiveness, you'll always come up short. You are not a machine. The ideal of human productivity is not acting like a robot. Humans need rest, relaxation, sleep, and play in order to function effectively. Too little of any of these things can seriously diminish your capacity to do good work and impact how much you enjoy your life. So how do you rest and recover? It's simple. Spend time doing something completely different from your normal activities and responsibilities. The less overlap between your hobby and your work, the better. During World War II, Winston Churchill was under as much stress as a person can withstand. As Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, he was responsible for leading the defense of Great Britain from 1940 until the end of the war in 1945. The fate of a country and the freedom of its people depended upon his fortitude and persistence for 5 long years. How did Churchill keep from collapsing under such a heavy burden? In the book Painting as a Pastime, Churchill explains how spending time painting helped him recover from the demands of war and politics. And I quote, "Many remedies are suggested for the avoidance of worry and mental overstrain by persons who, over prolonged periods, have to bear exceptional responsibilities and discharge duties upon a very large scale. Some advise travel, and others retreat. Some praise solitude, and others gaiety. No doubt all these may play their part according to the individual temperament. But the element which is constant and common in all of them is change. Change is the master key. A man can wear out a particular part of his mind by continually using it and tiring it, just in the same way as he can wear out the elbows of his coat. There is, however, this difference between the living cells of the brain and inanimate articles. One cannot mend the frayed elbows of a coat by rubbing the sleeves or shoulders, but the tired parts of the mind can be rested and strengthened, not merely by rest, but by using other parts. It is not enough to merely switch off the lights which play upon the main and ordinary field of interest. A new field of interest must be illuminated. It is no use saying to the tired mental muscles, if one may coin such an expression, "I will give you a good rest, I will go for a long walk," or "I will lie down and think of nothing." The mind keeps busy just the same. If it has been weighing and measuring, it goes on weighing and measuring. If it has been worrying, it goes on worrying. It is only when new cells are called into activity, when new stars become the lords of the ascendant, that relief, repose, and refreshment are afforded. End quote. If Winston Churchill could find time to paint in the middle of a world war, you can find time in your busy schedule to rest and recover doing something you enjoy. Dedicating guilt-free time to rest and recovery can simultaneously make your life more enjoyable and more productive. Testing. I write best early in the morning, after 8 hours of sleep. After waking up, I drink 2 mugs of coffee, each containing 1 tablespoon of unsalted grass-fed butter and refined coconut oil, and turn on a bright blue LED lamp that simulates morning sunlight. Once I'm nourished and alert, I open up my computer, turn off my internet connection, and start writing. Once I get started, I can concentrate on writing for up to 6 hours without stopping if I'm not interrupted. Writing is important to me, so this is what I do every day. I've tested many different approaches, testing many different variables. This is what works best for me, so I've made it a habit. Will this be my method forever? I doubt it. I'll eventually find other methods that work even better. My experimentation never stops. Testing is the act of trying something new, a way of applying the scientific method and the iteration cycle to your own life. The most happy and productive people I know all have something in common. They're always trying new things to see what works. You can't make positive discoveries that make your life better if you never try anything new. Testing doesn't have to be complicated. All that's required is choosing some part of your life to focus on, then trying new ways to get what you want. You can test random approaches or read about what works for others, then test the approach yourself. Externalizing your results in a notebook can help you keep track of what you've tried, what works, and what doesn't. Here's a simple structure that will help you plan and track your experiments. Number 1, observations. What are you observing in your life or business that you want to improve? Number 2, knowns. What have you learned from past experiments that might be related to your observations? Number 3, hypotheses. Based on what you've observed, what situations or factors might cause or contribute to your observations? Number 4, tests. What will you try or change to improve your situation? Which hypotheses will this experiment test? And number 5, results. What happened after each test? Does it support or disconfirm your hypothesis? Here are a few questions to help you discover things worth testing. How much sleep do you need to feel rested and alert? Which foods make you feel energetic after eating? Which foods make you feel ill or lethargic? When do you do your most productive work? Are there any patterns in terms of your productivity? When do you get your best ideas? What are you doing when they occur to you? What is your biggest source of stress or concern? When do you start worrying, and why? Once you've found a pattern in one of these areas, it's time to start experimenting. Consciously change your approach to one of these areas of your life and externalize the results. If you find a change useful, keep doing it. If not, stop doing it and try something else. Testing is the best way to ensure that your life gets better over time. By constantly trying new things, you're learning what works for you and what doesn't. Over time, you'll discover patterns, things that make your life better and things that make your life worse. The results of your experiments accumulate until they inevitably produce the results you want. You never know until you try. Mystique. There's a big difference between liking the idea of being or doing something and liking the actual being and doing. It's easy to like the idea of being a CEO for a Fortune 500 company. It's harder to like the hours, the responsibility, and the pressure that comes with the top job. It's easy to like the idea of being a manager. It's harder to like the demands from C-level executives, surprises from your direct reports, and the necessity of defending your turf in a political environment. It's easy to like the idea of having an Ivy League MBA or law degree. It's harder to like the six-figure debt and the corresponding necessity of getting a stressful 60-plus-hour-a-week job to make the investment worth it. It's easy to like the idea of being self-employed. It's harder to like the fact that 100% of your income comes from your own effort, and that if you screw up, you're the one who will face the consequences. It's easy to like the idea of raising millions of dollars of venture capital. It's harder to like the fact that you've given up control over the project you're investing your life in. It's easy to like the idea of being an author. It's harder to like the solitude, the self-doubt, and the long hours of button chair hands-on keyboard that consistent writing requires. It's easy to like the idea of being a celebrity. It's harder to like the inevitable scrutiny, loss of privacy, and constant fear that people will direct their attention away from you in favor of the next big thing. Mystique is a powerful force. A little mystery makes most things appear to be a lot more attractive than they actually are. Fortunately, there's an easy way to counteract mystique. Have a real human conversation with someone who's actually done what you're interested in doing. Here's what to ask. I really respect what you're doing, but I imagine it has high points and low points. Could you share them with me? Knowing what you know now, is it worth the effort? This conversation will only take a few minutes, but you'll be amazed at what you learn, on both the positive and the negative side. No job, prospect, or position is flawless. Every course of action has trade-offs. Learning what they are in advance gives you a major advantage. You can examine an option without idealizing it, then choose if it's really what you want to do before you start. That kind of knowledge is priceless. The hedonic treadmill. Let's assume that you believe buying a fancy new car will make you happy. In the short term, it might. For the first week or so, you'll probably experience great pleasure when you drive. Over time, however, your joy will fade, an experience psychologists call hedonic adaptation. Before long, your new car will blend into your surroundings, and your mind will fixate on something else to pursue in the quest for happiness. This cycle is called the hedonic treadmill. We pursue pleasurable things because we think they'll make us happy. When we finally achieve or acquire what we're seeking, we adapt to our success in a very short period of time, and our success no longer gives us pleasure. As a result, we begin seeking something new, and the cycle repeats. The hedonic treadmill explains why people who achieve wealth, status, and fame continue to seek more. Since we're not satisfied with what we have for very long, it's only a matter of time before we fixate on something else to achieve or possess. The hedonic treadmill is a major problem if you'd like to experience a feeling of success or achievement for an extended period of time. It's possible to work hard, invest, sacrifice, and push your way to the top of your field, only to find yourself restless and despondent. You'd be surprised at how many successful people aren't happy with their lives, even after they've achieved everything they set out to do. Short-circuiting the hedonic treadmill is tricky. It's a side effect of caveman syndrome. There are, however, a few things we can focus on that tend to lead to sustained levels of life satisfaction. Based on the available research, here are five priorities that will contribute to your long-term happiness in a way that minimizes hedonic adaptation. Number one, work to make enough money. Money contributes to happiness, but only to a certain point. According to a 2010 study by Daniel Kahneman and Angus Deaton, money has a positive correlation with reported levels of happiness up to an annual household income of approximately $75,000 per year, which represents an income in the top third of U.S. households in 2008-2009, the years of the study. Reaching this level of income requires effort, but it's very achievable. Average U.S. household income during the years of the study was $71,500. Once you have enough money to cover the necessities and a few luxuries, you reach a point of diminishing returns. Every additional dollar you earn doesn't provide the same amount of utility. Beyond the point of diminishing returns, having more money doesn't increase happiness and may actually decrease it by becoming a source of stress and worry. For examples of how money can decrease happiness, read the book Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want by Richard Watts. Knowing your monetary point of diminishing returns is useful. By consciously limiting your consumption beyond a certain point and establishing long-term savings, you can reap the benefits of financial security and resilience without spending every waking moment working to pay for pleasures you'll adapt to in less than a month. As a general rule, experiences contribute more to happiness than material goods. Beyond the point where your needs are met, you'll get a higher emotional return for your dollar by traveling with people you like than by purchasing an expensive luxury item. Number 2. Focus on improving your health and energy. Health is a major contributing factor to happiness. When you feel great, you're more likely to feel happy. The converse is also true. When you feel ill, you tend to experience less pleasure, enjoyment, and life satisfaction. Experimenting with ways to improve your typical level of health and energy can result in huge improvements in your quality of life. Remember, the human body has performance requirements. Food, exercise, and rest are not optional. If you make it a priority to give your body what it needs to thrive, you'll reap the rewards over the years to come. Number 3. Spend time with people you enjoy. One of the single biggest predictors of happiness is the amount of time you spend with people you enjoy, family, friends, and like-minded acquaintances. The context and environment are less important than the people you spend time with. Different people need different levels of social contact to feel happy. Extroverted people feel energized by social contact and need to be around others on a regular basis. Introverted people, like me, can go days or weeks with little social contact and generally get their energy from spending time alone. Still, introverted people benefit from spending time with people they like. Regular social time with friends is highly correlated with major sustained increases in life satisfaction. Long meals and trips with friends are a great use of time. According to George Valiant, the project's director, the results of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, the longest-running longitudinal study of mental health, boil down to this, and I quote, "The only thing that matters in life are your relationships with other people," end quote. Number 4. Remove chronic annoyances. There are many things in life that can wear on your nerves. Examining ways to reduce or eliminate chronic stresses or annoyances can generate significant improvements in life satisfaction. If you find driving in rush hour traffic stressful, moving closer to work is a good solution. If you don't like your current job, start looking for another. If you find working with a particular customer annoying, fire them. If you always forget to pack your laptop's power cable when you travel, buy a second cable that stays in your travel bag. By finding simple ways to remove unnecessary stress and frustration, you'll spend less time and energy feeling bad and more time feeling good. Number 5. Pursue a new challenge. Most people assume retirees feel overjoyed, but that's often not the case. It's common for people to derive a sense of purpose and enjoyment from their work, and retirees can feel empty and lost when their former career is no longer a priority. Left unresolved, this sense of loss can spiral into depression. The solution is to take on an exciting new challenge. This challenge can be anything: mastering a new skill, completing a big project, or pursuing a major accomplishment. Whether it's learning a new language, playing an instrument, building something from scratch, or completing a marathon, striving for new achievement is the best way to experience happiness and growth over long periods of time. Focusing on experiences over material goods goes a long way if you want to step off the hedonic treadmill. In the immortal words of Charles Kingsley, a 19th century historian and clergyman, "We act as though comfort and luxury were the chief requirements of life, when all we need to make us happy is something to be enthusiastic about." The comparison fallacy. In business and in life, it's easy to compare our situation to others. Status seeking ensures that we spend energy tracking our relative status to our peers, and most of the time our conclusions aren't favorable. We tend to fixate on what other people are accomplishing instead of what we need to do next to achieve our goals. When other people we know accomplish big things, it's easy to feel sad for ourselves instead of happy for their achievements, as if their success diminishes us in some way. It doesn't. The comparison fallacy is a simple idea. Other people are not you, and you are not other people. You have unique skills, goals, and priorities. In the end, comparing yourself to other people is silly, and there's little to be gained by it. Here's an example. One of my friends is very successful in business and makes about 10 times what I make each year. He has received a lot of public recognition for his work. His products sell well, and he enjoys his success. There's a lot to envy. Here's the other side of the coin. My friend works 12 hours a day, sometimes more. He doesn't have a family. He has a large staff that requires constant attention, and his business's overhead is more than 10 times mine. He's overwhelmed with email, phone calls, and meetings. He's under tremendous stress almost all the time. It's easy to see the benefits of my friend's life, and just as easy to overlook the trade-offs. That's the trick. He is successful in certain areas because he works very hard, and he's willing to pay the price of his success. If I could swap lives with my friend, I wouldn't. I'd be miserable. His life doesn't mesh with my priorities or how I prefer to live and work. The benefits he enjoys appeal to me, but I'm not willing to pay the price he's paid for achieving them. Remembering the comparison fallacy allows me to wish him well and stay focused on achieving the goals that are most important to me. I can be genuinely happy for his success and not waste my energy on pointless envy. The same trick works in any situation that has the potential of inflaming feelings of envy or inferiority. Whenever you're tempted to compare yourself to an acquaintance, colleague, classmate, or celebrity, it always helps to keep in mind that your goals, preferences, and priorities are completely different. You've lived different lives, and you've each paid a different price for what you've accomplished. Any comparison you make instantly renders itself invalid, so you can relax. The only metric of success that matters is this. Are you spending your time doing work you like, with people you enjoy, in a way that keeps you financially sufficient? If so, don't worry about what other people are doing. If not, focus on making changes that are within your locus of control so you can start moving in the direction you desire. Remember the comparison fallacy and keep moving closer to what you want. Locus of control. No matter how much you want a particular job, after the interview is over, you can't control whether or not you get the job. You've done what you could. No matter how intently you watch the stock market, you can't will the stock price of a particular company to go up. No matter how much you'd like to retain a key employee or make a personal relationship work, you can't prevent them from leaving if they want to. Understanding your locus of control is being able to separate what you can control or strongly influence from what you can't. Trying to control things that aren't actually under your control is a recipe for eternal frustration. As much as we'd like to, we can't control everything that happens to us. Natural disasters are a perfect example. If a tornado or earthquake destroys your home, there's nothing you can do about it. As uncomfortable as it is to imagine, the environment contains many things we can't control. It's a fundamental aspect of life that we can't change, no matter how much we might want to. Focusing on your efforts helps you stay sane. Turning results you don't directly control into goals is a recipe for frustration. One of the reasons that diets drive people crazy is that they involve trying to control a result, weight, that is not directly under their control. If you focus on efforts, eating healthy food, exercising, and doing what you can to manage related medical conditions, your weight will handle itself. Worrying about things you can't influence or control is a waste of time and energy. One of the best things I've ever done was choose to stop paying attention to the news. 99.9% of the information you'll find in a newspaper or television newscast is completely outside of your locus of control. Instead of fruitlessly worrying about what the world is coming to, Ignoring the news helped me spend more of my time doing what I can to actually make things better. The better you're able to separate what you can control from what you can't, the happier and more productive you'll be. Focus most of your energy on things that you can influence and let everything else go. Keep your attention on what you're doing to build the life you want to live, and it's only a matter of time before you get there. Attachment. Imagine you're on your way up Mount Everest, on the way to achieving your goal. The night before you plan to summit, a massive storm appears without warning. Visibility is zero, the temperature is steadily dropping, and conditions are so bad you risk falling or freezing to death if you continue climbing. Have you failed? When something outside of our locus of control affects our plans or goals, it's easy to take it personally. If you have your heart set on summiting Mount Everest today, you'll likely meet your doom. Far better to change your plans and live to climb the mountain another day. The more attached you are to a particular idea or plan, the more you limit your flexibility and reduce your chances of finding a better solution. It's good to be dedicated to the pursuit of your goals, but only to a point. If you become too attached to the visions you have in your head, you'll have a hard time adjusting to the twists and turns of life. Acceptance requires applying the concept of sunk cost to yourself. Imagine losing millions of dollars in the stock market, a horrible situation. No matter how much you rail against greedy bankers, corrupt politicians, or the unfairness of life, it's not going to bring that money back. Spending time feeling down for not knowing better or being omniscient won't improve your situation. The solution to attachment is accepting that your idea or plan is no longer feasible or useful. The less attached you are to your plans, goals, status, and position, the easier it will be to respond appropriately to inevitable change or unforeseen circumstances. If you suddenly lose your job, remaining attached to your previous position is a hindrance, not a help. It's better to spend your energy doing what needs to be done to bring in more income. The more you focus and accept the things that have happened and choose to work on things that you can do to make things better, the happier you'll be. Personal research and development. Every successful business dedicates a certain amount of resources to trying new things. Research and development, or R&D, is what business leaders around the world count on to determine what the company should work on next. Large companies spend millions, sometimes billions of dollars, in speculative research every year, experimenting with new techniques and processes in order to enhance their capabilities. R&D exists because it works. Companies that make research and development a priority often discover new products to offer their customers or process improvements that meaningfully contribute to the bottom line. If it works for them, it can work for you. What would it look like if you set aside a few hundred dollars a month as a personal R&D budget? Using the techniques discussed in the book I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi, it's remarkably easy to automatically divert a certain amount of your monthly income into an account earmarked for personal R&D. That money can then be used, guilt-free, for purchasing books, taking courses, buying equipment, or attending conferences, anything that will improve your skills and capabilities. Personal finance experts might disagree with me here, but I think having a robust personal R&D budget is more important than maximizing your savings. I'm all for having a well-funded emergency account and saving enough for future needs, but savings can only get you so far. Investments in improving your personal skills and capabilities can simultaneously enrich your life and open doors to additional income sources. New skills create new opportunities, and new opportunities often translate into more income. Your ability to save is limited. Your ability to earn is not. Here's a simple planning exercise that will help you establish your own personal R&D budget. What would have to change to be able to dedicate at least 5% of your monthly income to personal development and experimentation, assuming your current income stays the same? Any money-saving tip you find in good personal finance books or blogs can be used to fund your personal R&D account. For details, I recommend reading the book Your Money or Your Life by Vicki Robin and Joe Dominguez, as well as following GetRichSlowly.org and TheSimpleDollar.com online. All it takes is a little creativity and budgeting, and you'll be well on your way to funding your own self-directed research and development laboratory. Limiting belief. In general, there are two primary ways of looking at the world, two mindsets that influence your response to new experiences. The first basic mindset is that your skills and abilities are fixed. If you try something and it doesn't work, it's because you're not good at that, and you never will be. You were born with innate skills and abilities that will never change. Using this mindset, if you experience a challenge or difficulty, you're likely to stop. You're obviously not good at it, so why bother? The second basic mindset is that your skills and abilities are malleable. If you try something and it doesn't work, it's because you haven't worked on it very much, but if you keep trying, you'll get better. Your skills and abilities are like muscles. They strengthen with use. If you experience a challenge or difficulty, you're likely to keep going. You might not be good at it yet, but you're always getting better. These two mindsets color how you experience everything in the world. In the book Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, Dr. Carol Dweck calls these mindsets the fixed and growth theories of intelligence. If you have a fixed mindset, challenges are a commentary on your worth as a person. You've been tried and found wanting, which makes trying new things feel threatening. If you have a growth mindset, challenges are simply an obstacle to be overcome by working harder. The fixed mindset is an example of a limiting belief, something that you believe is true about the world that holds you back from achieving a goal you value. The fixed mindset isn't true, but it's capable of holding you back if you choose to believe it. Some limiting beliefs are the result of errors in pattern matching. Here's a common example. If you believe that wealthy people are superficial, unethical, or corrupt, you'll find it difficult to make money. If you make more money than you make now, you'll become one of those people, and the thought will make you uncomfortable any time money is an issue. If you don't identify the conflict and resolve it, money matters will always make you uncomfortable. Your mind is not malfunctioning. Part of your brain is anticipating the future and trying to protect you from something that you don't want, but it's going about the task in a counterproductive way. To make progress, you have to identify and eliminate the beliefs that are holding you back. Everyone has limiting beliefs in certain areas. Anytime you use the words, "I can't," "I have to," or "I'm not good at," you've discovered a potential limiting belief. Most of the time, taking a moment to consciously question the belief is all you need to do to break it. Is that really true, or how do I know that's true, are very powerful and versatile self-elicitation questions. Limiting beliefs may also appear when you consider doing things that make you uncomfortable, like applying for a new job or selling an offer to a new prospect. Images of rejection and disapproval start flashing through your mind, and your first impulse is to conclude, "This won't work," before conducting a single test or gathering real feedback. Here's a useful rule of thumb for these types of situations. Make the other party tell you no. This is a habit worth installing. You may believe you're going to be turned down when you make a request or propose an idea, but make the other party say it instead of assuming it's a given. You'll be surprised at how often you get what you want, even when you believe the odds are slim. The way you choose to respond to challenges determines how successful you ultimately become. It's important to realize that you have no fundamental defects. There's nothing that you're fundamentally incapable of doing or learning. It may take time and effort, but you'll improve eventually if you make the effort. Viewing your mind as a muscle is the best way to help it grow. Chapter 8. Working with others. Working with other people is an ever-present part of business and life. You can't escape it, even if you want to. Customers, employees, contractors, and partners are all individuals with their own unique motivations and desires. If you want to do well in this world, it pays to understand how to get things done with and through other people. In this chapter, we'll discuss how to work effectively with others. You'll learn how to communicate more effectively, earn the respect and trust of others, recognize the limitations and pitfalls of group interactions, and lead or manage a team of people effectively. Power. All human relationships are based on power, the ability to influence the actions of other people. We can never control people in the sense that we've discussed in the section on perceptual control. We don't have direct access to the inner processes that make people do the things they do. All we can really do is act in ways that encourage people to do what we suggest. The use of power typically takes on one of two fundamental forms, influence or compulsion. Influence is the ability to encourage someone else to want what you suggest. Compulsion is the ability to force someone else to do what you command. Encouraging an employee to go the extra mile out of a sense of loyalty or craftsmanship is influence. Forcing the employee to work over the weekend by threatening to fire them if they refuse is compulsion. The actions that employee takes may be exactly the same, but how they feel about taking those actions will be quite different. On the whole, influence is much more effective than compulsion. The vast majority of people naturally resist being forced to do something against their will or better judgment, so constantly relying on compulsion to get things done is a poor strategy. Bossing people around only serves to make them dislike you, and they'll find ways to retaliate or quit working with you at the earliest available opportunity. Influence, on the other hand, is sustainable. Encouraging people to want what you want gets you the results you're looking for without provoking unnecessary ill will. Like it or not, everyone relies on power to get things done. In the book The 48 Laws of Power, Robert Greene argues that no one is completely exempt from dealing with others, which inevitably involves power. Power is a neutral tool, one that can be used for good or ill. Power represents your ability to get things done through other people. The more power you have, the more things you can do. Accordingly, there's nothing morally wrong with consciously seeking to increase your power, provided you respect the rights of other people. The more power you have, the more you can ultimately accomplish, but with great power comes great responsibility. The reason that interactions among large groups of people inevitably become political is the ever-present nature of power. If you don't have a plan, your actions will be determined by someone else. By refusing to make the effort to move in the direction you think is best, you're ceding power to those who do have plans. Refuse to understand that power is important, and you're likely to find that any influence you have rapidly disappears. The only way to win is to decide to play. The best way to increase your power is to do things that increase your influence and reputation. The more people know your capabilities and respect the reputation you've built, the more power you will have. Comparative advantage. Essential to the idea of working with other people is the question, why work with other people in the first place? If you can't control them and get them to do exactly what you want them to do all the time, why bother? The answer is comparative advantage, a concept that originated in the dismal science of economics. Attributed to David Ricardo's 1817 text, On the Principles of Political Economy and Taxation, Ricardo's law of comparative advantage provided an answer to a question of international politics. Is it better for the economies of countries to be self-sufficient and produce everything themselves, or specialize in producing certain goods, than trade with one another? Using Portugal and England as examples, Ricardo calculated that even if both countries were capable of producing cloth and wine, England could produce cloth with much less effort, and Portugal was much better at producing wine. As a result, instead of wasting time and money struggling to do something they weren't good at, Portugal and England would both be better off if they specialized, then traded with each other. Comparative advantage means it's better to capitalize on your strengths than to shore up your weaknesses. In the book First Break All the Rules by Marcus Buckingham and Kurt Kaufman, and the book StrengthsFinder 2.0 by Tom Rath, the authors share the results of the Gallup Organization's comprehensive research on human productivity. As it turns out, comparative advantage applies as much to individuals as it does to countries. Businesses work better if the individuals who operate them focus on what they're best at, working with other specialists to accomplish everything else they need. Quote-unquote, strengths-based management is simply another term for comparative advantage. Comparative advantage explains why it often makes sense to work with contractors or outsourcers rather than try to do everything yourself. If you want to build a house, it's probably more efficient to hire a general contractor and specialists who do the kind of work the project requires every day. You could certainly try to do it yourself, but unless you know what you're doing, it'll probably take longer, and the results won't be as good. Comparative advantage also explains why diverse teams consistently outperform homogeneous teams. Having a wide variety of team members with different skills and backgrounds is a major asset. It increases the probability that one of your teammates will know what to do in any given circumstance. If every team member has the same skills and the same background, it's far more likely the team will get stuck or make a preventable error. Self-reliance naturally improves your flexibility and knowledge over time, but too much self-reliance is a mistake. I'm a huge advocate of self-education and learning how to do things yourself, but taking the do-it-yourself ethic to an extreme can do more harm than good. Working with others can help you get more done, faster, and improve the quality of the end result. Even Thoreau left Walden Pond every once in a while to buy things in town. The major benefit of self-education when working with others is knowing what skill looks like. You may be able to hire a programmer halfway around the world via Elance.com or Odesk.com, but if you've never done any programming yourself, you're going to have a difficult time figuring out whether or not their work is actually good. Learn a little programming, however, and your ability to identify good programmers will increase, making you more likely to identify skilled colleagues and partners. In the immortal words of John Donne, no man is an island. Focus on what you can do well and work with others to accomplish the rest. Communication overhead. There's a reason high-performing surgical teams, military units, and sports teams tend to be small and focused. Too much time spent in communication and coordination can kill a team's effectiveness. Communication overhead is the proportion of time you spend communicating with members of your team instead of getting productive work done. In order to keep everyone on the same page, communication is absolutely necessary. The more team members you have to work with, the more you have to communicate with them to coordinate action. As the number of people you work with increases, communication overhead increases geometrically until the total percentage of time each individual must devote to group communication approaches 100%. After a certain threshold, each additional team member diminishes the capacity of the group to do anything other than communicate. Large companies are slow because they suffer from communication overhead. If you're responsible for working with a group of more than 5 to 8 people, at least 80% of your job will inevitably be communicating effectively with the people you work with. Objectives, plans, and ideas are worthless unless everyone involved understands them well enough to take action. I experienced this daily while working at Procter & Gamble. One of my primary projects consisted of creating a company-wide strategy on how to measure certain marketing tactics. Because it was a global project, my recommendation required input and/or approval from dozens of individuals across the company before anything could be implemented. Naturally, everyone involved had different ideas, argued endlessly over various approaches, and wanted to share of the credit without having to commit too much work or expense. I spent 3 months of full-time effort simply putting together a workable proposal. In the meantime, no actual work was being accomplished. 99% of my time was spent doing little more than communicating with other members of the group. That's communication overhead. In the book Bureaucratic Breakdown, Derek Sheen proposed 8 symptoms of bureaucratic breakdown that appear in teams suffering from communication overhead. Number 1, the invisible decision. No one knows how or where decisions are made, and there is no transparency in the decision-making process. Number 2, unfinished business. Too many tasks are started, but very few are carried through to the end. Number 3, coordination paralysis. Nothing can be done without checking with a host of interconnected units. Number 4, nothing new. There are no radical ideas, inventions, or lateral thinking. A general lack of initiative. Number 5, pseudo-problems. Minor issues become magnified out of all proportion. Number 6, embattled center. The center battles for consistency and control against local and regional units. Number 7, negative deadlines. The deadlines for work become more important than the quality of the work being done. And number 8, input domination. Individuals react to inputs, that is, whatever gets put in their in-tray, as opposed to using their own initiative. If any of these qualities describe your daily work experience, your team is probably suffering from a case of communication overhead. The solution to communication overhead is simple, but not easy. Make your team as small as possible. You'll be leaving people out, but that's the point. Including them is causing more work than it's creating in benefit. Removing unnecessary people from the team will save everyone's time and produce better results. Studies of effective teamwork usually recommend working in groups of 3 to 8 people. In the book Peopleware, project managers Tom DeMarco and Timothy Lister recommend keeping teams elite and surgical. Small teams tend to be more effective than large groups because communication overhead is reduced. Each team member adds more capacity to the team than they require in communication to be effective. Once group size expands above 8, each additional team member requires more investment in communication than they add in productive capacity. If you want your team to perform at its best, make your teams as small and autonomous as possible. Importance. Everyone has a fundamental need to feel important. It doesn't matter if you're dealing with a customer, an employee, an acquaintance, or a friend. The more important you make them feel, the more they'll value their relationship with you. Make someone feel small or unimportant, and you'll earn their enmity in record time. How do you feel when you're talking with someone who's checking their BlackBerry or interrupts your conversation to take a phone call? The more interest you take in other people, the more important they will feel. The reason you don't feel valued when a sleazy car salesman asks, "How are you doing?" is that you know the question doesn't indicate genuine interest. It's clearly a means to close the deal. People want to feel important even if they don't buy from you, which is where canned sales scripts fail. Fortunately, making others feel important is not particularly difficult if you make an effort to be present and curious. It mostly has to do with undivided focus, paying attention, listening intently, expressing interest, and asking questions. Being the complete focus of someone's attention is so rare in today's world that it makes a memorable impact almost immediately. Cultivating a genuine interest in other people goes a very long way. The more important you make people feel when they're around you, the more they'll like and want to be around you. Safety. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Seriously, did you even think that through before you opened your mouth? Ever had a meeting like that? I have. Unfortunately, this type of interaction happens all the time. In the book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, veteran executive coach Marshall Goldsmith explains that high-level executives often subtly, and sometimes blatantly, put down their peers and subordinates to make themselves feel smarter or more important. What putting others down actually accomplishes is shutting down effective communication. Effective communication can only occur when both parties feel safe. As soon as people start to feel unimportant or threatened in a conversation, they start stonewalling, shutting down communication. The threatened party may continue to interact, but mentally and emotionally, they've withdrawn from the conversation. The only way to prevent stonewalling is to make the person you're communicating with feel safe being open and honest with you. Just as people have a fundamental need to feel important, people also have a need to feel safe when expressing what's on their minds and talking about things that are important to them. The moment they begin to sense that they're being judged, evaluated, or looked down upon because of an idea they have or a position they hold, they'll shut down. In the book Crucial Conversations, a book about maintaining a sense of safety while discussing important issues with colleagues and loved ones, authors Kerry Patterson, Joseph Grinney, Ron McMillan, and Al Switzler recommend using the STATE model to communicate without provoking anger or defensiveness. Number 1. Share your facts. Facts are less controversial, more persuasive, and less insulting than conclusions, so lead with those first. Number 2. Tell your story. Explain the situation from your point of view, taking care to avoid insulting or judging, which makes the other person feel less safe. Number 3. Ask for others' paths. Ask for the other person's side of the situation, what they intended, and what they want. Number 4. Talk tentatively. Avoid conclusions, judgments, and ultimatums. And number 5. Encourage testing. Make suggestions, ask for input, and discuss until you reach a productive and mutually satisfactory course of action. Some people are more sensitive than others. Becoming more aware of your words and actions and how they might be interpreted by people with different attitudes is half the battle. If you want to communicate with someone in a way that you both benefit from the conversation and get something done, both parties need to feel safe. The best way to make that happen is to avoid passing judgment and focus on making the other party feel important. Books like Crucial Conversations, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, and Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goldman can help you learn how. The Golden Trifecta. If people have a fundamental need to feel important and safe, how do you go about making that happen? The Golden Trifecta is my personal three-word summary of How to Win Friends and Influence People. If you want to make others feel important and safe around you, always remember to treat people with appreciation, courtesy, and respect. Appreciation means expressing your gratitude for what others are doing for you, even if it's not quite perfect. Imagine that you're designing a product and your lead designer shows you some mock-ups that you believe won't work. Bluntly responding, "This is totally wrong, do it again," is a good way to make your colleague feel unimportant and insecure. Instead, express appreciation. "Thanks, it's clear you worked hard on this and I appreciate that. I'm not sure if we're there yet, so here are a few ideas that may help." It's the same content, but delivered in a very different tone. Courtesy is politeness, pure and simple. I once heard courtesy defined as accepting small inconveniences on behalf of another person, and I think that's a very useful definition. Opening the door for another person is a small inconvenience, but it can have a major impact on how they perceive you. There's no need to make every petty issue a big deal. Respect is a matter of honoring the other person's status. No matter how you relate to the person you're communicating with, respecting them as an individual is critical if you want to make them feel important or safe, no matter how high or low their social status. It's important to apply the Golden Trifecta to all of your interactions with other people, not just the people you're particularly interested in. If you've ever had lunch or dinner with someone who was nice to you but was rude to the waitstaff, you know what I mean. Treating other people poorly sends a clear signal to everyone that you can't be trusted. If you make it a policy to treat people with appreciation, courtesy, and respect in all circumstances, other people will feel important and safe in your presence. Reason why. Here's a fascinating quirk about asking people to do something. They'll be far more likely to comply with your request if you give them a reason to do what you ask. In the book Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion, Dr. Robert Cialdini describes an ingenious experiment that demonstrates this principle in action. In the 1970s, Ellen Langer, a psychologist at Harvard University, conducted a set of famous experiments about compliance, what makes people agree to a request. The experiment centered around a busy copy machine on the Harvard campus. Langer's students asked people waiting in line to use the copy machine if they could move to the front of the line, using various approaches. A straightforward request was honored 60% of the time, but Langer found that adding a reason for the request increased the compliance rate to 95%, an astounding improvement. The technique worked even if the reason was vacuous. "Because I have to make copies" worked just as well as "because I'm late for class" or "because I'm in a rush." All the reason had to do was supply a because, and it was enough to make people agree to the request. Humans are predisposed to look for behavioral causes. People will be more receptive to any request if you give them a reason why. Any reason will do. Commander's intent. Almost universally, people hate to be told exactly what to do. Micromanagement is the bane of any worker's existence. If you're a competent professional, nothing is more demeaning than someone else defining and scrutinizing your work to the last detail. Micromanagement isn't simply annoying, it's extremely inefficient. Not only does spelling out every single detail make people feel less important, it actually impairs their effectiveness. No set of instructions, no matter how detailed, is capable of covering every contingency. When something changes, micromanagement fails. Think of how overwhelmed a CEO who insists on micromanagement will become. Remember, human beings don't scale. The more people who work for the company, the more directions the CEO must give to keep everything moving. If you have 10 employees, micromanagement is a hassle. If you have hundreds or thousands, it's a nightmare. Commander's intent is a much better method of delegating tasks. Whenever you assign a task to someone, tell them why it must be done. The more you're